A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, folks, and welcome once again to the Tennis Podcast, episode 6 of Tennis Relived. Happy Independence Day to our American listeners. It is the 4th of July. I mean, by the time a lot of you are listening to this, it will no longer be the 4th of July. So I hope you had a good one. if you're listening to it post July the 4th, 2020, you might be listening to this a ways into the future, because we're hoping that these Tennis Relived podcasts that we're making and loving making will stand the test of time. I think they're the first podcasts that I don't feel touchy about recommending that people go back and listen to. Anything else in our archive, just give it a swerve. But these, I hope, will stay in the vault for a long time. And today feels like a really big one, because we're going to be telling the Jana Novotná story. So hanky's at the ready. I've got mine ready here. David, were you queuing at the pub at 6 a.m. this morning, like the absolutely insane people of Great Britain apparently were doing?
Yes, because the pubs have officially reopened. No, I wasn't, Catherine. I'm not a pub goer at 6 a.m. normally.
I'm not sure anyone is normally.
No, and I'm not today either. but I was using a hanky earlier, because I was watching, I watched a little reel of the Jana Novotná story in the space of 2 minutes, and that set me off. And then I listened to some of the audio we've got, and that set me off. And yeah, it's an incredibly emotional story we're about to tell, but it's also a wonderful story we're about to tell. It's just one of the moments that is impossible to avoid when you're covering and reliving Wimbledon, because Jana Novotná was so important and so special to so many people.
Yeah, very, very well said. I mean, it's a pod that I've been sort of relishing doing, and also kind of dreading doing, because there's the anxiety about whether we were able to do it justice. But we've certainly put everything into it that we can. We've got some great audio from Jana's coach, Hannah Mandlikova. She coached her throughout her career, pretty much, and through all three of her Wimbledon finals, and Mary Carrillo and Chris Clary as well. So we're going to do our best to bring the story to life. Matt Hairdresser's also opened today. You've got a big decision to make about whether you stay committed to the rock star look or whether you revert to your previous look. Have you any thoughts?
I'm 100% reverting. This is not a look that should be staying.
It's had very strong reviews, though.
It has. But
has it?
I've only sort of posted the best of it. When I've, you know, when I've put product in my hair.
Yeah, Matt's discovered hair products during the pandemic.
It now takes me an extra 2 minutes in the morning to get ready when I want to look presentable.
I'm quite into the product-free version, which is kind of Noel Gallagher-esque.
You've gone from Kevin Curran to Noel Gallagher in the space of 3 days.
I actually think I most look like Goran in the Wimbledon final we watched yesterday.
Folks, that is not how Matt expressed it first time around on WhatsApp. He said, triumphantly sent us a message saying, "Goran looks like me." yeah, which he did.
I mean, I actually hate going to the barber normally because of the small talk and general awkwardness of the situation, but I'm actually really looking forward to my next next trip. This needs to go. But I wasn't looking forward to it enough to be there at 9 o'clock this morning. No.
I think PPE might save us all from hairdresser small talk for the next, well, for years to come. So every cloud, everyone. Big decision to make here. I'm going to put this to both of you. I don't know why I'm letting you make the call. But we're covering a number of years on today's podcast. We'll be covering the 1993 final, won by Steffi Graf after Jana Novotná had a 4-1, 40-15 lead in the deciding set. She was 5 points away from winning that title. We'll be covering a little bit the 1997 final, the Jana Novotná's second, which she lost out to Martina Hingis. Bit less so. We'll be doing a separate podcast on Martina Hingis and her becoming the youngest ever Wimbledon champion when she won the title. And we'll also be covering, of course, in great detail today, the crowning moment of Novotná's career, finally lifting that Wimbledon title in 1998, beating Natalie Tauziat in the final. So, would you like to hear what happened in the world in 1993, in 1998, or both?
Can I have 93 and 98, please?
Do you concur, Matt?
Yes.
The listeners are shouting, God, no, wrong decision, David. But you asked for it, so here goes.
That was the cleanest decision-making we've ever had.
Yeah.
Normally these things take a lot more time than that.
Normally I'm asking the public.
Well, 93 was a big year. It was the year that Jurassic Park was released. It was the year that Meatloaf's I'd Do Anything for Love was the best-selling single. It was the year that Dominic Thiem, Kiki Mladenovic, Garbiñe Muguruza, Sloane Stephens, Ariana Grande, Harry Kane, and friend of the pod Liam Payne were born.
First time he's ever been described as that in public.
Does that need explaining?
Is he going to sue us?
He was on it. We've got it. It's on. It's in the archives, folks. There's another one you can go back in the archives to listen to. 2015 June and something like that. Anyway, and Liam Payne of One Direction, fellow West Bromwich Albion fan, was on the podcast with me, Andy Murray, and Jack Whitehall. There you go.
And he broke our Twitter feed.
It was a dark time on Twitter for a while after that.
That was a scary moment. But I harassed him into tweeting that he was on the podcast, and suddenly his 100 million followers or whatever he's got started tweeting us.
We were getting tagged in all of his insane marriage proposals, which was a very weird glimpse into a strange world. It was the year that Dyson sold the first bagless Hoover. Ben Johnson was banned from athletics for life. Buckingham Palace welcomed visitors in the summer for the first time. Kim Campbell became the first female Prime Minister of Canada. And of course, in tennis terms, it was the year that Monica Seles was stabbed in Germany. And sadly, that is one of the things that people will remember about the tennis year in 1993. So it goes without saying that Seles was absent from Wimbledon that year. And for that reason, Graf was the very, very heavy favourite. I mean, she would likely have been anyway. She was the two-time defending champion. She'd won 4 Wimbledon titles overall. She was the top seed. She was expected to win that final against the number 8 seed, Jana Novotná, who Bud Collins in the broadcast we watched, the NBC broadcast, kept telling us was the 33-1 outsider, according to English bookmakers prior to the tournament. I don't know whether American bookmakers had entirely different odds on Jana Novotná, but the British bookies had her at 33-1 before the tournament.
Yeah. Actually, I don't think they do sports betting in America, really, do they?
It's certainly way more heavily regulated and sort of generally weird, yeah.
Yeah. No, he really liked that line. And I remember watching the match and coming into the final, and I knew a fair bit about Jana Novotná, because this was right in the sweet spot of my fandom of tennis, and when I'm just literally watching any tennis that exists, and to hell with everything else in my life. So I knew a lot about Jana Novotná, but at the same time, Graf was such a heavy favourite, and it felt like that too. It didn't feel beforehand like that this would be much of a final, just because Graf was just dominating everybody, really, at that time, her having not got Seles to contend with anymore. But the way that Novotna played that day was majestic. It was absolutely majestic. The way she moved around a tennis court, her intent and her commitment to serve and volley and slice and coming in, and there were expressions that I've heard people use that she would sort of float around the court. She had this wonderful movement. And there's one moment in the NBC coverage where she leaps for a volley and everybody in the commentary box goes, "Whoa!" And then Bud Collins goes, "Bird woman!" And it is a great image to sum it up, the way it felt that nothing is going to get past her that day. And she lost a very, very tight first set on a tie break, but then just took over, completely took over. She was brilliant. Graf was poor. And it was very nearly a bagel second set. And she managed to get the one game. And then it just carried on in that vein throughout much of the third set until, well, we know what happened.
Yeah, I think it's really important to stress how well Jana Novotna was playing that Wimbledon and in that final, because obviously the story is what happens as she collapses in that third set. But you know, in the quarterfinals she'd beaten Sabatini 6-4, 6-3, despite having six consecutive losses to her beforehand. In the semifinals she'd beaten Martina Navratilova despite a 0-5 head-to-head record. She was playing the tennis of her life. She'd got into her second Grand Slam singles final. And yeah, as you said, she was majestic against Graf for much of that 93 final. You know, the lob she was coming up with, the touch, the sort of brush strokes, manoeuvring the ball around the court. They call her the last kind of pure, true serve volleyer in women's tennis. And she's so magnificent to watch and so good with it as well. And Graf didn't really have any answers until the final set.
I didn't realise what an extraordinary athlete she was. I mean, she might not have had quite the exquisite touch that Martina Navratilova had, particularly perhaps on the forehand volley, and certainly that was what came to let her down in the big moments. But her athleticism was Navratilova-esque, potentially even Navratilova plus. It was extraordinary to see that combination of strength and grace in terms of her movement and her net coverage, because Steffi Graf was good at threading a passing shot. I mean, she was doing an incredible shot at a job of every now and then just sneaking in a topspin backhand passing shot, or certainly a flat backhand passing shot, and threading them down the line and scooping her forehand returns cross court, dipping to the feet of Jana Novotna, and she just seemed to be everywhere, Novotna. And so good at getting low to the ball. The strength in her legs and her quads was extraordinary.
Yeah, that was the what really struck me, was how low she was to the ground, and that was seemed to be back then, particularly on those sort of grass courts, key to having success. And when she established that lead, I mean, afterwards Steffi Graf is saying, "I thought I was going to lose. I was basically accepting defeat, really, in my mind, because she's getting outplayed. There's nothing. She's got no answer to the tennis that's coming to her." And then things changed, and you saw that moment, and it was hard to see.
Who can bear to describe it to us?
Is this the moment where we have to talk about it?
Yeah,
it is.
We've put it off long enough. I mean, obviously, I saw it live. I saw this match live. And I'm trying to remember when I started to get nervous on her behalf at the time.
The serve that went 3 meters out?
Yeah. But the thing is, I think what happens, and it actually, the same feeling comes over you when you're rewatching, reliving it, as we just have this morning, is that she hits that one. And even back then, I remember looking at her face and just thinking, uh-oh. You know, And you could sense that in the commentary box. And what really got me today rewatching it is how quickly it all happened from there. Mm. It just, in a flash, she's suddenly 4-5 down and on the brink of defeat. And she's 4-1. What was the scoreline? She's 4-1.
She's 4-1, 40-30 when she hits the double fault. And that is the kind of symbol, I think, of this collapse. That's the point that's always replayed. That's the one I've seen.
And she loses 3 points in a row, doesn't she?
Yeah, it actually gets worse than that.
It actually gets worse. The next 2 points, she misses a forehand volley. Again, it hits the back before it hits the court. And then she misses a smash into the bottom of the net and then that's her getting broken for 4-2. She then gets to 15-40 on Graf serve. So you're kind of thinking, okay, she's taken a breath, she's recovered a little bit, but then Graf plays a good game to hold to get to 4-3. And then it's that game again where it's such a tough watch because she double faults twice in a row, I think, Novotna, to hand the game to Graf to get it back on level terms for all. And then I think Novotna only wins one more point in the whole match. As you said, it just happened so quickly. There's no time to sort of stem the tide. It just runs away from her.
In an absolutely masterful moment of understatement, when Bud Collins asks Novotna in her NBC post-match interview where it all went wrong, Novotna said, well, that double fault I hit at 4-1, 40-30, that was unnecessary.
Yeah. And actually, that little succession of errors there is when you feel this is she's in real trouble here. And even though she has that little spurt, I remember watching at the time, you're kind of hoping for the best for her, but you're not expecting it to go right. Because when you start missing by that degree, you know that I've heard Andy Roddick talk about how you're suddenly gripping the racket too tightly, and it no longer feels part of your arm the way throughout the entire match to that point the racket had just been an extension of the arm. Suddenly she's holding something that isn't her racket. It's just like a rock. It was tough to see. And then incredibly emotional afterwards when she's involved in that trophy presentation with the Duchess of Kent.
Yeah, one of the most iconic moments in Wimbledon history. You'd probably have to say thank goodness by that point the runners up were receiving their trophy, the silver salver, before the winner. And Jana Novotna is called up by the Duchess of Kent, as was customary. And it's so relatable and classic, isn't it? When you're right on the edge emotionally, the absolute last thing you need is someone being nice to you. I mean, it's also the thing you need the most, but it just sends you right over the edge. And you could see her falling over that precipice. The lip goes, she tries to bury her face in her hands, and then she buries her face in the shoulder of the Duchess of Kent. And it's the picture that was on in all the papers the next day. It is still one of the most iconic images that tennis has ever produced.
That moment is where you had households that maybe two people were watching the match and two people were doing something else, and the two watching the match shout to the other two, you've got to come in and see what's going on here. This has never happened before. And seeing an interview with the Duchess last night, several years later, she said, well, it's the most normal thing in the world, isn't it? If you see somebody upset, you give them a hug. And that's what she did. And it was just so relatable, I think, to everybody who was watching. And it remains the iconic moment of Jana Novotna's career, as much as winning the title, I think.
And what strikes me when I watch that moment is how public it is and how exposed she is. You know, by all accounts, she was quite a private person, Jana Novotna. Okay, she was open about being quite vulnerable, but a lot of the time she was private and kept herself to herself. Well, this was suddenly she was so exposed, so bare. And in the kind of cutthroat world of sport, you could imagine her other opponents thinking, oh, this is an edge now we've got over Jana Novotná. There was absolutely no hiding there. And I think I was really pleased actually to read some quotes that Novotná had on that moment a few years later, where she had this sense of perspective on it, where she said, you know, it was a beautiful moment for everyone, really. And I think actually it's good to show your emotions. It can lift you up, is what she said, and which is an extraordinarily healthy kind of capacity for that self-expression and self-reflection. And obviously it has turned into this iconic moment. And I think she was at peace with it as a moment, as opposed to it sort of haunting her in a way, which it could easily have done.
And I think both parties sort of later revealed what was said in that exchange between Jana Novotná and the Duchess of Kent. And, you know, it was along the lines of, don't worry, you will come back and you will win this. You're too good and particularly too good a grass court player not to. And that was, I think, the feeling of everybody else at the time. I mean, watching the match, she looked too good a grass court player not to win Wimbledon. And we're going to hear from her coach for the first time now, Hannah Mandlíková. Wonderful, fascinating interview I got the chance to do with her a few weeks ago. Somebody that we don't really hear very much from in the tennis world. So it was a great, great pleasure to be able to speak to her. And she starts off by talking about Novotná's journey to becoming a grass court player and the convincing that it took to make her believe that she could be at home on grass.
I tried to convince her of it because, you know, she always saw that she's a better clay court player than a grass court player. And I said, Jana, it's absolutely nonsense. You should be on the finals of Wimbledon, or at least semifinals all the time, because nobody plays your game anymore. You can serve in volley. Your slice is very, very good. Your chip and charge is good. So I kind of tried to put it in her head that she started believing that she can do so well on grass. And that's how it happened, you know. She lost to Graf when she was up set and 4-1, 40-15. And she kind of couldn't handle that situation, which she was never in before, serving, you know, being up so far, like so much, and then losing. And I think that picture of Duchess of Kent when she was crying on the shoulder made her more popular than anything else in her career.
Do you remember what Jana was like after that match?
Very disappointed, but you know, she was crying in the dressing room, very down. But Jana had an exceptional, you see, every champion has something special what the other doesn't. And I can tell you a good story where she was up against Chanda Rubin in the French Open on the center court. She was up set 5-love, 40-love, and she lost the match. And that was 2 weeks before Wimbledon. She came off the court, and in 2 days, she totally recovered from that match. So she went back on the court and started working very hard. So her exception was that she was an unbelievable fighter. And unbelievable, she forgot what happened in the past. But it's very difficult for other players to do that. That's why she recovered from all the losses she should have won very fast, by working very hard.
So interesting, isn't it? Because you've got the balance of it becomes a vicious circle with... I know Novotná herself never perhaps embraced the C word, the actual word choke, but she certainly owned her losing from winning positions, those situations, not just the Wimbledon one, but that other famous one that Hannah Mandlíková referenced there, losing to Chanda Rubin at the French Open. The vicious circle of the more it happens, the more you think it's going to happen, and therefore the more it happens, because the fear of it happening is almost the nail in the coffin, isn't it? And that scar tissue, we've talked about it with so many current players, that scar tissue, it builds up before you even realize it. And it's not just the fact of it, it's also the perception of it, as you've sort of alluded to, Matt, the fact that every player in the locker room will have seen that 1993 match will have seen her just crumble when it mattered most, and that chips away at your aura.
I mean, I saw that Chanda Rubin match, and because I already had, I'd known she'd lost matches against Sabatini from Match Point Up, and I'd seen this graph final, you're ready for it. The moment she starts to lose a couple of points, you start to hear murmurs in the crowd. You start to hear commentators talking about it. And so obviously doesn't necessarily mean that she's aware of what people are saying, but what must be going on in her mind. So it does, as you say, it becomes a vicious circle.
Mary Carrillo, like everybody, I think absolutely loved Jana Novotna's game, but here she is talking about it, but also reflecting on what a tough watch. And I'm sure you can tell from the tone of our voices that we found it a tough watch this morning. What a tough watch the latter stages of that 1993 final were.
Boy, she had a good game, didn't she? She had it, but again, it, like, you could tell when Jana was getting tight. She had that thing dead to rights. And when you watch Jana struggling so much with her serve, with her shot, like everything was flying off her racket. The promised land was right there and she couldn't make it. It's like watching someone having to dance at their own funeral. You know, it's just like, oh God, don't. Like, unfortunately, well, the great part of tennis is that there's no substitutions. The clock doesn't run down. You can't hold the lead and skate to the finish line. You know, you just got to finish it off. I think even Groff, I've never asked Steffi about this, but I'll bet even Groff will allow that it was a sad win. You know, it was a tragic loss for Jana, but I think it was almost a sad win too, because Groff didn't beat Jana at the end. Groff just stood around while Jana beat herself.
Oy. Yeah, you can't park the bus in tennis, can you? You can't nick a 1-0 lead and then throw 10 men behind the ball. And to be fair, Jana Novotna absolutely did not do that. She had one way of playing, and that was to be gutsy and aggressive. And she didn't err from that. It was just the execution that completely deserted her.
Yeah. P.S. Ultimate Tennis Showdown. You cannot run down the clock in tennis. And I think Martina Navratilova has said that Jana Novotna didn't lose to Steffi Graf. She lost to the Wimbledon final, which is an incredible quote just to sort of showcase how much the moment kind of defeated Novotna in that final. And I think there's also an interesting conversation to be had about how, you know, we've talked about Novotna being an intelligent, smart tennis player. I know we've talked before on the podcast as well about choking being linked to intelligence and the kind of, you know, tight moments in sport call for instinct and simplicity. And I think it seems like Novotna's jammed, like her processes are jammed by the thinking and the complexity. And I don't know whether you've ever read David Foster Wallace's sort of savage takedown of Tracy Austin's autobiography, where he makes the point that should have been a great story for Tracy Austin, because she was so young, she won the US Open, there was a lot to unpack. She should have had a lot of interesting things to say. And Tracy Austin wrote that, "I won the US Open and I was thrilled." And and his point is, you know, we've all done those interviews with players where they give a sort of stupefyingly empty answer. What was going through your mind? Oh, I was just focusing on the moment. And the point David Foster Wallace makes is maybe that is the answer. Maybe they do have that kind of empty mind. And that's the key to not choking, to not thinking about things. It's maybe that's the essence of kind of succeeding in sport, to blank everything else out. You know, cliche alert, tunnel vision. But what makes Novotna so special is that she doesn't seem to quite be able to do that. And it's such a human reaction. And also just a testament to the way she played the game, I think.
My figure skating coach once said to me, "You'd be a really good skater if you could turn your head off." Which, you know, at a really, really low level, really low, is the same principle, isn't it? She said, I can see the thoughts going through your mind as you set up for a jump. She said, I can see you picturing yourself falling. I can see it in your eyes. I can see it going through your mind. And I totally get that. I know it is the enemy of tennis journalists and interviewers everywhere, that line about staying present, focusing on the moment. I mean, my heart just sinks when that rhetoric comes out. But I know why they, and I know they mean it. I know it's something that I, as a mere mortal that spends my whole life with my brain running a million times an hour, having completely unproductive, unhelpful thoughts, can't relate to. But, you know, that's why they're not mortals. That's why they're multi-Grand Slam champions, because they are able to stay present, stay in the moment. As much as that sounds gobbledygook to me, to you know, to the likes of, I always think Nadal is a great example of that. It's just hit tennis ball, isn't it? See tennis ball, hit tennis ball. And I'm not saying he doesn't have tactics or thoughts, but I don't, you know, he's not thinking about the past or the present or the consequences. He's thinking about that point and that moment. And I'm not sure I've ever experienced that.
That's why I never choke, you see, because I'm thick.
Let's hear from Chris Clary for the first time. We're gonna be hearing from all these people again, because this is only one chapter in the story. But Jana Novotná was somebody that he very luckily had the chance to get to know very well.
Well, Jana, I got a chance to interview her a number of times for magazine stories, and so I got a chance to really get a good sense of the person, and what a intelligent, you know, sensitive person she was. So I think that was the challenge for her, was to sort of calm the mind and quiet all the thoughts that were going on in there and let the game speak. And so it's a great story, because there are plenty of situations where you falter, you don't come back and get another shot at it. And she finally got the breakthrough that she wanted, a bit like Goran, finally being able to break through and get what he richly deserved. But I think for Jana, the thing was interesting too, is that she was able to articulate all that very well. You know, she wasn't all bottled up. She was able to really express, when you got her away from the tournament where things might be happening, where it was all too much, she was incredibly in touch with her emotions and her sense of vulnerability on the court. I remember talking to her once about, I remember using the word choking, and she goes, "Oh, that's such a dirty word." But you know what? It's okay. Because I can actually see how it could apply in this case.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
She did some work for BBC Radio, didn't she, David? Some commentary. Did you ever have the chance to work with her?
I did, yes. I commentated alongside Jana a couple of times. And I felt quite in awe of her, really. She had this quiet, serene composure as she would sit there watching the match, and her eyes would never leave the court. She was sitting right alongside me in the commentary box, and she would, you know, a lot of commentators, you would turn to one another to have conversation about what you're watching, and she wasn't being rude. She was just in love with what she was watching. She was totally wrapped up in it, and her analysis was just fascinating. I loved kind of. Depends on who you're commentating with. Some people, you would want to engage them on a subject, on a talking point. With her, you'd almost just want to describe, leave it, and let her fill in the gap, because she was going to tell you something about the sport, about the actual tennis points that I can't see as somebody who doesn't play the game. And it was just riveting, really, to listen to it.
One of my favourite quotes of hers, Matt, that you dug up in the research was, post-retirement, she was asked, you know, whether she had taken a complete break from tennis, as so many of them do, whether she was still playing, still watching. And she said, oh, gosh, yeah, I haven't gone a day without tennis, and I can't imagine going a day without tennis. She just was completely in love with the sport. And that's infectious, isn't it? That's it sings through the screen when you're watching her, even in her darkest moments. And of course, there was another one to come in 1997, not as dark as 1993. And I mean, she was a setup in the 1997 final against Martina Hingis, but I'm not sure, even despite that, many people see it as necessarily one that got away. I mean, Martina Hingis was a Wimbledon champion that day. She was brilliant, and she absorbed the story, because it was such a brilliant story, one we're going to do a pod on in itself. You know, her becoming the youngest ever Wimbledon champion, still the youngest ever Wimbledon champion, 16 years of age, and it kind of deflected a bit from the continuation of the Jana Novotna story, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think separately, Hanna Manikova said to you that Jana had pulled a stomach muscle, I think, ahead of that final against Martina Hingis. So although she was playing really, really well physically, she wasn't what she was in 93 and 98 on that particular day.
And I think especially, as you know, a stomach injury for Novotna with her game, as we've been talking about, that serve coming into the net afterwards, you know, it's all putting pressure on that area of the body. And if she was anyway compromised, it sounds like she was in the second and third set against Hingis, and then Hingis just, as you said, kind of took over. I think there was I'm not going to go too much into depth into the match, because as you said, we'll be doing that tomorrow, but just from a Novotna standpoint, apparently she did jokingly sort of grab the trophy at the end of that match and do a kind of mock lifting of the title, and some incredible sort of rare diplomatic quotes from Hingis afterwards, saying that
Oh, I'm not interested in diplomatic Hingis, Matt. That's not what we're here for.
Well, I'm only interested because it's Hingis. Just, you know, just saying that Jana deserved that title. And, you know, as much as she was a Wimbledon champion in waiting, Hingis, so too was Novotna.
And once again, the Duchess of Kent was there to give Novotna her silver salver. And it's understood that what she said to her was, it'll be third time lucky. And look, we've seen plenty of and heard plenty of lines like that in commentary and in punditry over the course of the last few weeks that have turned out not to be very true and have taken on a real air of tragedy and pathos. But thankfully, and apologies to Natalie Tozier and Natalie Tozier fans out there, but thankfully, mercifully, it was third time lucky in 1998. It was Frenchwoman Natalie Tozier that Jana Novotna met in the final. And though she fought valiantly in that second set, did Tozier took it to the tiebreak, it was relatively smooth sailing, wasn't it? And thank goodness for that, that she didn't have to get into too much of a squeaky bum time position, because who knows what might have happened.
Yeah, and if you look at the time span between the 93 final and the 98 one, as well as the 97 loss to Hingis, who was the dominant player that year, one of the greats in terms of talent, she'd also had two defeats, two separate defeats to Graf in at Wimbledon. One of them a semi-final from a set up, and the second one was a straightforward win for Graf. So, you know, she was running into the best at every stage. That although yes, she kind of lost her own opportunity in 93, she was at least running into the best. In 98, suddenly she's playing somebody that is not going to be classified as the best. She was the favourite. She was absolutely the favourite for the title that day.
And that puts a completely different complexion on the match, doesn't it? That was the first time she'd been the favourite for a final, certainly the heavy favourite. And that was something that Hanna Mandlikova reflected on as well during my interview with her. And I asked what the crucial difference was between Jana Novotná of 1993 and the one that finally lifted the title in 1998.
She had to start believing herself in the crucial moments. You know, you can believe your coach when we're training and everything, but then when you step on the court, all the decisions and everything is up to you. And she had to learn to, you know, bite the bullet. And she did it finally against Ozil in 1998, where, you know, it was actually more pressure on her playing Tauziat, who beat Davenport in the semifinals, because she's supposed to, on paper, win like 100%. So can you imagine? She knew this is going to be her last chance in her career. So the pressure was even bigger and greater than the two before. So I think, you know, she handled it awesome. And she won finally Wimbledon. I was so happy for her. And in a way, you know, Wimbledon was always my favorite tournament. I was only twice in the finals, never won it. It was my dream. Didn't happen, but through Jana, kind of, I fulfilled my dream a little bit.
Did you start to doubt that she would fulfill that, yours and her dream of winning Wimbledon?
Winning Wimbledon. Now I can be a little bit honest, more honest than before. I felt like that finals against Steffi, she really should have won. And that was her chance. So that was her real chance. And I hope that she's going to have another chance. But, you know, you still train hard and everything. But I was a little bit doubting it that she will have another chance. But she did, so.
Going into that Wimbledon in 1998, how was she kind of emotionally and psychologically? Was she scarred by those big losses in the past, or did she really believe?
Yeah, no, I mean, she felt the night before, we look at Natalie's Stosia tapes and we spent 2 hours of talking about it, about the whole situation, what can happen on the court. And, you know, she knew this is her last time. She knew it. She told me, I know this is my last time. I'm going to do utmost I can to win. But you never know what can happen. So she knew it was her last chance.
Well, how much do you remember of the match itself against Tosia?
What I remember, the first set she won pretty easy. The second set, they were holding serves. And then Jana played an exceptionally good tiebreak. I was more nervous that match than any other match watching Jana, because I knew how much she wanted to win and how many chances she had in the past to do it. So I was so relieved, you have no idea.
Was it more relief than joy?
It was both. It was, for Jana, it was disbelief that she finally did it. For me, you know, I remember all those endless hours on the court we spent or me convincing her that she can do it. And, you know, she can be a top three player or four, whatever, you know, because she doubted herself all the time in the past. And for me, as I said, you know, it was a big thing as well. I never won Wimbledon. So for me, as I said, was like I was a little bit part of it, you know. It meant a lot to me, you know, because I know how much she wanted it.
Can you remember what the celebrations were like that night?
Yes, I do. I remember, like, you know, I don't know what time it finished, but she had no dress, so they borrowing dresses there. So we quickly had to get dressed for the ball and to the early hours in the morning celebrating.
She'd had so many years to dream about what it would feel like to be a Wimbledon champion. Do you think it lived up to everything she hoped it would be?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Wimbledon, not only in my mind, but I think in every player's mind, is the epic of everything. You don't find a Grand Slam like that anywhere else.
Anyone missing Wimbledon?
Oh, just a bit.
Oh, it's, I mean, it's a tough listen, that in a number of ways, but it's a wonderful listen as well, isn't it?
And it's an indication of tennis being able to tell human stories, because that, you know, Jana Novotna's story is such a triumph of the human spirit, really. It's kind of inspirational, you know. There is joy and redemption to be found. You're gonna have to walk through a lot of darkness and dark places to get there. But if you can get through it, there's light. And just the way she was able to have her moment of joy at, you know, finally at Wimbledon, you know, because people, as we said, people associated Novotna with not doing it, and finally she was able to do it. And I think, you know, I think the 93 Wimbledon final will often get remarked upon as the more famous Novotna one, but this one is the completion of the story. And and to think that Mandlikova kind of went through it with her as well is really an added special element to it.
Well, I can't understate, at the time watching it, the universal reaction of happiness and celebration of just people who only switched on tennis once a year for Wimbledon, but they all knew Jana Novotna because they'd all seen her in the same position 5 years earlier. And I do feel a bit sorry for Natalie Tauscher. I hope she doesn't know too much about it. She seemed okay in the interview we saw her in afterwards. But, you know, I just felt the whole country that I was living in anyway, and I didn't work in tennis yet, everybody was just chuffed for Jana Novotna.
Well, Tozier gave that amazing line to Bud Collins afterwards. She said, well, I think at the end there, Jana wanted it more than me. And look, I know still waters run deep and everything, but she didn't seem as devastated as some Grand Slam final losers might be. And I'd like to think that part of that was maybe because, you know, she could at least share in a little bit of the joy of seeing somebody as deserving as Jana Novotna lifting the title, even if it was at her expense.
I think she's quite an interesting player in her own right, Tozier, actually. She wrote a book while she was on tour about the kind of underside of the tennis world. It's in French, but apparently that is quite interesting. And I believe she was heavily involved in Bianca Andreescu's career. She coached her through the junior ranks. So, yeah, I mean, she's a side story inevitably here, but I think she's quite interesting in her own right. But there's something else that Novotna changed for this Wimbledon final, which was inviting her mother for the first time. Her mother had never seen her play a Grand Slam match because Novotna was superstitious, I think it sounds like, and she didn't want to change her routine. But third time lucky, she thought, OK, something needs to change here. Let's invite my mum. And she flew over from the Czech Republic on the Friday night, I believe, and was then there in the box when Novotna wins and climbs into the box. And she first goes over to Mandlikova, gives her a great big hug, and then goes straight for her mother as well. Really touching scenes. Sorry.
Yeah. It really got to me, the embrace with her. My mum's the spitting image of her, or the other way around, I suppose. Oh yeah, it's quite a moment, and it was a moment that of course was made all the sweeter because of what had gone before, what she had been through in order to get there, and that's something that that Mary Carrillo reflected on.
It's not that hard to get a reputation in anything. Trying to kick it loose is much, much tougher, and I think that is what. I think, frankly, that Novotna didn't have to go through a top player to take her major title, to take Wimbledon. It had to have helped. And normally, you know, you think, Novotna in a major final, I'm assuming the other guy is going to win, the other player. But in that case, I think all of us thought, yeah, okay, Jana, no matter what you've suffered, no matter what kind of luggage you've got, you're taking on the court, you've got this. She was a lovely person too, and she knew her. She was really candid. She was very frank about her struggles, which I always found so endearing. You know, she didn't try to say I didn't choke. I don't know if you're the same way about this, Catherine, but when I hear Serena say I never choke, you know, like when she did in the semis at the U.S. Open, you know, when she was trying to win the calendar Grand Slam, I never choke. Look, everybody chokes. I just wish Serena would, because one of my favorite parts about Serena Williams is that she chokes and then she wins anyway. She figures out a way to, all right, what can I do here to restabilize? That to me is a greater strength than saying I don't choke. That she has time and again come back. To me, that's like one of the great things to watch. So for Serena to say, no, I never choke. No, yeah, sure you do. That's cool. I mean, to me, give me a choker over a tanker any day of the week. Choking means you care. You know, that's what it was about with Novotna. That's what it was about with Gabby. That's about anybody, you know. It's about McEnroe against Lendl. He choked because he cared. Why deny that about yourself?
That, I mean, I don't believe in fate or mystical anything. I'm a very rational, scientific, boring kind of person. But that 98 victory for Novotna, I mean, if anything was going to convince me or turn me, it would be a moment like that, a day like that. It did feel like the universe wanted Jana Novotna to have a Wimbledon.
I think you're right. I think, and it was everybody who was watching Wimbledon that day in the set, everybody knew what it was all about, right? I mean, we all knew what she was trying to get over. Putting yourself out there is, to me, that just counts for so much, you know? And I think you can only be truly accomplished at something you love. And clearly, Novotna had worked her whole life trying to get to that moment because she loved it. And that she finally won. And same with Halep, same with anybody who finally comes good at anything. You know, you knew what it'd take for them to get there. You knew that they had to just keep trying. You know, what's better than that?
Anyone want to try and follow up those words from Mary Grillo? I mean, there's just so much in there that so perfectly expresses so many things.
I think it's perfect perspective on this idea of choking as well, because, you know, when you see someone choke occasionally, you can almost find it funny in a way. And I don't mean to make that sound cruel, but, you know, we were laughing yesterday about Andre Gagassi. You know, there is a sense that it can be almost comical, but at the same time, it is because you care, and Mary's completely right. Putting yourself on that line is to be admired, and it's such a shame, really, that someone who chokes in the final will get more flack than someone who loses a comfortable match in round one. You know, it's to do with the spotlight and, you know, the intensity of that moment. But the fact is, you're getting to the final. Okay, you might not be able to get quite over the line, but at least you've got there. And, you know, I think it's kind of a bit of a lesson, really, that we shouldn't joke about that kind of thing.
Well, I think we all perhaps feel entitled to joke about it because it's relatable for us, because those are the sort of mistakes that we as mere mortals make. And there's a amazing paragraph that you dug up, Matt, from the LA Times at the time in 1998. Lisa Dillman of the LA Times said, "This win was for everyone who lost the tennis match they should have won. This was for two women who shaped her game and psyche, Hannah Mandlikova and Betty Stove, two players who came within a match of winning Wimbledon themselves. This was for the Duchess of Kent, who supplied comfort and reassurance, predicting Jana Novotna would win Wimbledon on her third attempt in the final. And the Royals are never wrong, right? But most of all, it was for Novotna." And obviously it's desperately sad that Jana Novotna isn't with us now. She passed away in 2017 of ovarian cancer, and it's just desperately sad. But thank goodness she had 20 years to enjoy being a Wimbledon champion.
Yeah, that's the only thing that you can comfort yourself with, really, I think. Because, I mean, what was she, 49 years of age? It doesn't seem right. And, yeah, it's astonishing to me that that's 3 years ago. It feels like a few months ago that I heard that news, and it stopped everybody in their tracks because, as you said, she was a private person. It wasn't something that got lots and lots of coverage, and desperately sad.
She was incredibly private about her illness. She didn't even disclose it to some of those closest to her, and that actually includes Hanna Mandlikova, who was a longtime coach as well as friend, and it was a huge shock, clearly, to Hanna.
Just tell you the truth, when that happened, I just couldn't believe it. I got a phone call from Helena Suková early in the morning, and she told me the bad news, and I just was like lying in the bed thinking, this is not real, this is not happening, I just talked to her on her birthday, what's going on? She told me she's doing fine. So it was total shock for everybody, for me, for the whole world. And I want her to be remembered as the biggest fighter that there is, for a nice, very nice person, happy person, and she should be very proud of her career.
And she's left quite a legacy to the sport. I mean,
absolutely, absolutely.
Her connection with Wimbledon in this country is so strong. I think most people here would see that photo of her from the ceremony in 93 and recognize it instantly. And of something so powerful about her story, I think. And
you
I
see,
hope
that's how she is. You know, that she was very open. She didn't hide anything. You know, if she felt like, for example, for me, I was much more inside person. If something like that would happen to me, I would not show my emotions. She was showing her emotions because that's the person she was. And if she felt like crying, and it's just, she was very emotional player and an emotional person off the court as well.
I'm so grateful to Hanna Mandlikova for giving us her time and giving us the opportunity to hear her pay tribute to her, because, you know, I didn't know Jana Novotná and I wish I did. I'm so pleased, David, that you got the chance to work with her, but to hear that tribute from somebody that knew her best is really, really special. And I just want to finish on some words from Chris Clary one last time from the New York Times, on her loss and how hard it hit the whole of the tennis world.
So sad that Jana died so young. But I think, given that tragic fact, the fact that she was able to think of herself, rightly so, as a Wimbledon singles champion for all those years that she did have after her career ended, and there weren't enough of them. But imagine how much meaning that brought her on a daily basis, David, you know? And that's something that I guess I'm more aware of that now as I get older and I look at these things that happen to players. And I was definitely aware of it when Goran won Wimbledon, that he can always say, you know, I'm a Wimbledon champion. And I think being able to say that changes the arc of your life in retirement all the way through. And you go to these commemoration ceremonies and they always bring the old tennis players back. You know, you see it again and again. And to have not be able to say you're a Grand Slam champion at this stage would be tough. You're with all your peers, and so it has a lot of resonance and meaning for a long time. So there's the joy of the moment and the release of the moment and the moment earned, but then there's the way it kind of keeps paying dividends throughout your life.
Yeah, beautifully said. And yeah, a small positive chink of light in, you know, what's a sad ending to the story. She's the only open era women's singles champion that we've lost, amazingly. And she'll never be forgotten, will she? I mean, obviously, as a Wimbledon champion, she'll never be forgotten. But that image of her crying on the Duchess of Kent's shoulder will never, ever be forgotten.
No, she is one of those champions that touched everybody, meant something to everybody who watched her journey. And I also think for future generations, I think I could show those images to my 8 and 10 year old kids, and they would understand what was going on. They would understand those moments of desperately wanting something so much and coming up short, but then getting over the line eventually. And I think that there is a great lesson in there. And I think Mary summed that up so well in what she said about how you've just got to keep putting yourself out there. You've got to keep giving yourself that chance and exposing yourself to the possibility of disappointment once again, because that's ultimately the only way you're going to get there. If it means enough to you, you'll keep trying. And Jana Devine, and look, mate, it doesn't happen for everybody, but she kept trying and she got over the line. And it is a beautiful story, and it is a very hard thing to accept that she's no longer here at such a young age. But still, what a story. One of the great stories of Wimbledon history.
Yeah, it's not the time in your life, it's the life in your time, as they say. And Jana Novotná truly lived, you know, desperately sad that it was cut so short. But, you know, in the years she had, her story will resonate forever, really.
A lesson in there, perhaps, for Stefanos Tsitsipas and Aryna Sabalenka, who were both born in 1998. I realise that I forgot to tell you what else happened in 1998, so that's me shoehorning that in. Those two were born and the Monica Lewinsky scandal happened. So there we go.
And what's Hanna Mandlikova doing now?
Ah, Hanna Mandlikova is coaching her kids. I meant to look up what ages they are, because towards the end of the interview there were the sounds of thwacking tennis balls behind her, and I just said, oh, have you ever considered coaching again, because she's been away from the sport as far as I know. She said, I'm coaching my blooming kids, and I think they might both be junior players. She's based in the States now, Hanna Mandlikova. I think they might both be junior players over there.
Well, one of them's in college, in Oklahoma College, as a player on a scholarship, I believe. But and the other one has gone into the pros, and she said is around 500 in the world. But she actually said to you, I was listening to it this morning, she said, yeah, I'm back on the road. Can you believe it?
They always say never again, don't they? And I remember asking Goran once about his probably then 4-year-old son Emmanuel was brandishing a tennis racket with worrying skill, and Goran was there shaking his head saying, I didn't teach him that. And I said, you're going to be back on tour with him, Goran, and his face just crumpled in a heap. But then, you know, Goran seems to be looking for reasons to be back on tour at any opportunity. That was the Jana Novotná story. It was a wonderful pleasure to tell it. Obviously, some very harrowing aspects of it, but we'll never forget what she achieved at Wimbledon. And it's been a privilege to be able to tell that story on the Tennis Podcast. We'll be sort of retelling a little bit of it tomorrow, won't we? Because tomorrow is, we're still in the 90s, David. Chill out.
Phew.
Tomorrow is Matt.
Is Martina Hingis winning in 1997 and just generally having one of the great tennis seasons, really, that might be underrated, I think. I certainly don't think it's talked about as much as it should be, considering how great it was and how young she was. So yeah, 1997 is our destination tomorrow.
We love setting people straight on underrated tennis achievements, don't we?
So she's our middle Sunday bonus.
She's our middle Sunday bonus ball. Lucky you, Martina.
I mean, to be fair, the weather has been so bad in this week. We probably would have been play on middle Sunday at Wimbledon this year.
It has made missing Wimbledon slightly easier to take, hasn't it? The fact that it's been miserable outside. We wouldn't all have been sitting up on the roof with beers and strawberries and cream soaking up the sunshine, would we?
Just without them. Yeah, we'd still be up there.
Yeah. So that's for tomorrow. We're staying in the 90s, 1997. We hope you're enjoying them. We're loving them. Thank you to Gerald, as always, for being a rock star generally and for being our mascot. Thanks to Matt and David, to Andrew, who's helping with the research, and to Sarah as well, who is providing me with the weird and wonderful nuggets about what happened when, which I think it's pretty clear that I'm enjoying those. So, yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.